This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.
China's offshore currency falls to its lowest ever level against the dollar. Plus, Hurricane Ian churns toward Florida after knocking out power in Cuba. And we'll get the latest from Moscow as Russia readies steps to annex occupied regions of Ukraine.
One of the key things, though, is that Russia doesn't even hold completely any of those four regions. Ukrainian forces still are in a good chunk of them and pushing forward.
It's Wednesday, September 28th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin in the waters of the Gulf of Mexico, where Category 4 Hurricane Ian is forecast to make landfall between the cities of Tampa and Fort Myers later today. The storm is generating maximum sustained winds near 140 miles an hour and is expected to cause life-threatening storm surges and flooding in Florida. More than 2.5 million people in Florida have been ordered to evacuate ahead of the storm. Overnight, Hurricane Ian knocked out Cuba's fragile electricity grid, plunging the island into a total blackout. The hurricane is also affecting the congressional calendar in Washington. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot had intended to hold a hearing today, but has postponed it in light of the storm, saying a new date will be announced. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate has voted to advance a stopgap funding bill to keep the government open until December 16th. The bill now moves to final passage in the Senate and will also need approval in the House before heading to President Biden's desk. And in a final story from Congress, House Democrats have released a bill to ban stock trading by members of Congress, judges, and senior government officials. Proponents say new rules are needed to eliminate potential conflicts of interest, while critics say insider trading is already against the law and that new rules would impose unnecessary burdens on lawmakers. Lawmakers are hoping for a vote on the bill this week, but its passage is uncertain. Drug makers Biogen and Eisai say a study has shown that their experimental Alzheimer's drug significantly slowed progression of the disease. The results bolster the prospects for the drug to get regulatory approval. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is already reviewing whether to grant conditional early approval to the drug. And semiconductor maker Intel says it plans to start selling graphics chips for video gamers next month, entering a lucrative market currently dominated by competitors NVIDIA and AMD. Journal reporter Julie Steinberg has more on why Intel is re-entering the graphics processor market more than a decade since its last products were under development.
Their pitch is to gamers who are tired of paying sky-high prices for the fastest, most advanced graphics chips. Intel has been trying to revive its fortunes because the company has seen its market value slide in recent years. NVIDIA is now the largest U.S. chipmaker by market value, based on its appeal to gamers and the growing AI computation market. So this move reflects Intel's desire to get back in the game.
China's offshore currency has hit a record low against the U.S. dollar. The onshore yuan has also dropped, hitting its lowest level against the dollar since 2008, and all of this coming despite repeated attempts by China's central bank to support its currency. So what is behind this currency unraveling? Wall Street Journal China markets reporter Rebecca Fung joins us now from Hong Kong with the story. Hey, Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Luke.
Tell us very briefly the difference between China's onshore and its offshore currency markets.
Sure. So yuan, the currency used in China, is traded both in mainland China and in offshore markets like Hong Kong. And the offshore trading is actually only introduced in about 2010 to internationalize the currency. And the offshore trading is much less regulated compared with the onshore one.
What is the significance then of seeing the currency both offshore and onshore dropping as it has?
Well, first of all, it's the record low for the offshore. It's the lowest ever since it was introduced. And the onshore one this morning broke 7.2 as well. Economists would like to say that it's a psychologically important level. I think it's significant because although the fall in yuan this time around is more because of dollar strength than anything else, to be honest, but the fall makes it more difficult for the People's Bank of China to boost the economy. And the reason why it's more difficult for the central bank to boost the economy is because potentially it would need to cut benchmark interest rate to do that. But because of the yuan's weakness, it becomes more difficult to cut interest rate because that would push the yuan weaker against the dollar. There's also just very low business confidence right now in China. And for that to come back, the central bank should actually cut the interest rate, but it has more measures to do, like it can prop up the property sector or it can boost infrastructure spending, but those are likely to have a slower impact than directly cutting the benchmark rate.
Is the central bank expected to intervene, perhaps in some of the ways you've outlined that they could?
So it has been intervening, but it's using more indirect measures, such as it could set the daily fixing rate, which is this reference point for daily trading of the yuan, but not in the way that it directly intervenes. So it can, like the Bank of Japan did recently, go into the market and just sell dollar and buy yen. The central bank is unlikely to do that because it's basically the last weapon in their arsenal. And also the Central Bank of China has been trying to make the currency more market-oriented in this trading. So yeah, it's unlikely to do direct intervention.
That was Wall Street Journal China Markets reporter Rebecca Fung joining us from Hong Kong. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Coming up, we'll head to Moscow to get the latest on Russia's preparation to annex parts of Ukraine, the status of its military mobilization, and more. We'll have that story after the break.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. Insights. You need them to solve business problems, but buried in volumes of disparate data, they're seemingly invisible. C3 Generative AI enables business leaders to instantly access secure, hallucination-free, verifiable insights from a unified knowledge source, all with a natural language search. Turn the invisible into the obvious with C3 Generative AI. Learn more at c3.ai.
Russia is set to formally annex occupied territories in Ukraine after staging what have been described as sham referendums in the areas it occupies. Many Russians are also continuing to flee to neighboring countries to avoid being sent to Ukraine as part of a partial military mobilization announced by President Vladimir Putin last week. To fill us in on the latest, we're joined by Wall Street Journal Moscow reporter Evan Gershkovich. Evan, so glad to speak with you. Thanks for the time.
Hi, Luke.
So voting in these Russian-occupied areas of Ukraine is now finished. What are the results that have been announced, and what should we expect next?
In terms of official results, we had numbers come in yesterday, which were right what we would have expected. Most of the regions, which were Donetsk and Luhansk in the east and Zaporizhia and Kherson in the south, were seeing results of near 100% voting for. One of the regions had around 88%, which was stunningly low for what we would have predicted. The majority of these populations had emptied out since occupation. There were reports of pollsters going door to door with soldiers, essentially having people vote at gunpoint. We heard reports of ballot stuffing. So when we hear Western capitals call these elections a sham, it's because they're not really free in any shape or form. So next, we'll have Russian parliament next week basically approve the vote, and then Russia will consider those four regions Russian territory. One of the key things, though, is that Russia doesn't even hold completely any of those four regions. Ukrainian forces still are in a good chunk of them and pushing forward.
And assuming Ukraine's offensives into these territories continues, what does that set up?
Last week, when we heard Putin give this really strong or bellicose address to the nation, in which he both announced mobilization and started rounding up extra troops for his war in Ukraine, He also threatened the use of nuclear weapons, as he has done before. But he also, in that speech, made really clear that Russia will do anything to defend what it considers its sovereign territory. As soon as those four regions are considered Russian, any fighting on that territory, Putin has set up to describe as an attack on Russian sovereign territory. That could happen essentially immediately, as soon as he recognizes those territories, since Ukrainian forces are pushing forward. And so they're making gains in these territories that Russia will consider as theirs, and that sets up even further escalation than just simply a draft.
Speaking of the partial military mobilization you mentioned that President Putin announced last week, what is the status of that? It was ostensibly supposed to cover 300,000 or so military reservists, but what is the mobilization actually looking like?
It's looking very quick and chaotic at the same time. Right the day after, immediately started getting reports of thousands of men being drafted, mostly falling into the categories that the Russian Defense Ministry outlined. But we also saw tons of reports of basically men who hadn't even had fighting experience or men who were beyond the age limit for this reserve getting called up. And that was one of the reasons we're seeing hundreds of thousands of men also flee the country. Kazakhstan yesterday announced that nearly 100,000 people had entered the country since a week ago when Putin ordered this mobilization. And so at the same time as you're seeing a draft, you're seeing people really scared and wanting to flee.
I mean, on that exodus of Russians to neighboring countries and elsewhere, what has Moscow been making of this? Are they allowing this to occur?
We've gotten as well reports that at airports, men have been turned away. And at one of the border crossings where Russians are heading into Georgia, another neighboring country, that a mobile enlistment center has been set up. And yesterday, there were reports that men were getting drafted right at the border. So the Russians are clearly taking this seriously, even as chaotic as it's been. They want to make sure that they have enough men to defend those territories that they're about to annex in the east and the south of Ukraine.
And I would imagine, Evan, that this mobilization isn't cheap either. Are we kind of seeing that in the way it's being carried out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's early to say, but Russia had a reserve ahead of the war of certain money it can spend, and sanctions have limited its ability to tap resources. Obviously, it still has access to oil and gas, but this is just going to add to it. And we can see some of these stresses of trying to pay for this mass mobilization, because there are reports of men who've been drafted who are told you have to buy your own equipment. And I think there's two things we can glean from that. One, the army's resources are thin. And two, that can give us a preview of how well these men are even going to be able to fight when they get to the front lines in Ukraine. If resources are so thin that they're being told you have to buy your own bulletproof vest and helmet, that's quite telling in two ways, I'd say.
That was Wall Street Journal Moscow reporter Evan Gershkovich. Evan, be well. Thanks as always for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, is gray hair the new office power move? After the pandemic disrupted hair appointments, some women returning to the office are no longer trying to hide awkward dye lines or strategically place their headbands. Instead, they're embracing their natural color. Wall Street Journal Life and Work columnist Rachel Feinzig spoke to some of those women who, despite acknowledging biases against older women, decided they really don't care.
The women that I talked to, they just felt this deep sense of authenticity. A lot of them were surprised to find that they suddenly felt so confident and just more like themselves. I think it's the sense of accepting your age, of not maybe playing into society's expectations, trying to defy stereotypes about what it means to go gray. I think there is this bias that exists, a sense that if you let your hair go gray, you're just letting yourself go. You're giving up. You're not trying anymore. And I think that they're trying to kind of prove that wrong.
And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.